Hey, everybody.
Hi, welcome to Interview with an MVP. We're coming at you from the Channel 9 studios today with Dave Kawula, Clint Wyckoff, of course, and Alan Rayfuse.
Yeah, so we're here to discuss more Hyper-V operational training, Crystal. So we have a lot of information we're going to share with the community today about, you know, not just Hyper-V itself, but, you know, Windows failover clustering and some of the different areas that folks might, you know, run into problems in their environment.
Absolutely.
Because operational training is super important. And, you know, with that, let's, you know, Dave, why don't you kick things off for us here? Say hello to the viewers out there.
And not stack the Channel 9 buddy and actually pay attention to what we're doing. Hello, 150,000 viewers of Interview with an MVP. This is going to be a great session. Today we're going to be talking, as Clint and Crystal mentioned, about guest clustering. And so, oh no, not guest clustering. This is actual Hyper-V host clustering. The next episode's guest clustering. I sometimes get confused. I'm getting old. It's just happening, right? So anyways, I've got a really special guest here with us today here, Alan. And Alan, you actually have a ton of expertise in setting up production clusters, not only for Hyper-V, but for Exchange, SQL, and other workloads that are out there as well. So is this an important concept for us to really focus on?
Well, if you want to keep your systems up and running, you want to attain those five nines everybody's trying to strive for, then yes, you really need to understand the clustering. So there's a lot of step-by-step guides, but what I like to say is you need to also understand what you're doing when you're just following a step-by-step guide. So this session will be great to go through with people.
Would you say that it's a fair enough statement to say that, you know, where customers would get themselves into a lot of trouble with Hyper-V environments is incorrectly setting up failover clustering, not being able to actually fail over properly, you know, not understanding that when the power, you know, drops off one of the nodes, you lose a motherboard, for example, node dies hard. You've got to actually test that. You've got to make sure that everything is ready to go from an operational standpoint.
Well, one of the things is when you're out of the gate, you've planned for it. Everything's there. Everything's up and running. Mm-hmm. So you've planned for that. But as you're saying, operationally, we need to scale out. We need to make things grow because that's the whole goal of the infrastructure, is to make it grow.
Yeah.
So when we introduce new one node or five nodes, two nodes, things change. So we have to take into account the quorum. Like you're saying, if a motherboard dies, we still have to maintain that quorum. So coming back to networking, storage, how are we maintaining that quorum?
Well, and that's actually a really good point, is that what happens when, you know, we go through the life cycle of a Hyper-V infrastructure, specifically the failover clusters. Sometimes we would need to add or remove nodes from that cluster for just maintenance purposes or for growth. Now, probably one of the coolest features that I like in Windows Server 2016 is the ability to take and expand that cluster by adding Windows Server 2016 nodes to a Windows Server 2012 R2 failover cluster. And it's a way that we can actually kind of do an in-place upgrade with zero downtime.
Hold on a second here. So you mean to tell me, Dave, Crystal, right? Yeah. Did you know that you can run Windows Server 2016 clusters with Windows Server 2012 R2 in a
mixed mode
there?
Yes.
Yeah, that's something that's not been possible before. So what is that like? What does that create for environments, Crystal? You know, what is that? That gives them additional options when it comes to upgrading.
I was just gonna say, it gives you a lot more choices when you're building your infrastructure. You can put your new stuff and actually make it all work together without having to change everything over right away.
Right. So that way you can do kind of like a rolling cluster upgrade.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I have my Windows Server 2012 R2 environment that's running my current virtual machines. Right, this is Windows failover clustering. I can stand up a new Windows Server 2016 node on a piece of physical hardware, right? I can introduce that into the cluster, or I can evict one of the nodes after I've drained all the rules off of it, Dave,
yep.
Right? And then I can install Windows Server 2016 on it, add the right Hyper-V role, as well as the failover cluster, add it back into the cluster, move
things
along.
Can you switch it all back after?
Yeah, you can, and kind of The point where you get to the point of no return is whenever you actually upgrade the cluster functional level, right? So Windows Server 2012 R2, and then whenever you increase that to the Windows Server 2016, that is irreversible.
Once you switch the whole cluster over.
Well, correct. It's not technically irreversible. There is a fix for it. It involves you wiping the OS and going back to 2012 R2. There is always a way back.
There is. But, you know, typically that's not something that folks would want to do.
No, absolutely not. So, anyways, folks, I hope you really enjoy this episode that we've got for you. We're going to be talking about all things failover clustering from a host perspective and everything you need to configure. Thank you very much, and hope to see you guys soon.
Cheers.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to day 3 of our Hyper-V and System Center operational training. My name is Dave Kawula. I'm Microsoft MVP. You guys all know me. The people on this call here today are part of my customer base. Unfortunately, Clint won't be able to join us today. He had another appointment that was conflicting, so hopefully he'll be able to join us for the next session that we'll have coming up hopefully early next week. All right, let's get going here. Now, if you guys are new to the sessions that we've been doing here, if you're not on Twitter, get on Twitter, guys. Remember that you want to take and follow Clint and myself via our Twitter aliases. You can find us at Dave Kawula and at Clint Wyckoff. We post tons of information in regards to virtualization, so if you're not following us, make sure you do that. All right, so today's session is going to be another building block session that we had from the previous 2 days. And if you're new, because I know some of the audience that we have today didn't have a chance to attend the first 2 sessions, I provided the link to the previous recordings. I highly recommend that you go and listen to the previous 2 recordings so you can catch up a little bit. But what we're doing is we're taking the approach for this training to give you everything that's going to be required to operationalize yourself and your staff on Hyper-V and System Center. So regardless if we can get this done in 4 sessions, 8 sessions, 10 sessions, it doesn't really matter. We'll keep going until we've got everything that you guys require to feel that you're kind of operationally confident. So a couple of things that we're going to go through today is we're going to go through some basic constructs of VM creation as well as clustering and resiliency. So how Microsoft does high availability for Hyper-V is they use the Windows failover clustering role. So the good news for a lot of you is if you've seen this before in building SQL or Exchange clusters in the past, the UI is going to look fairly familiar for you. And if you haven't, this is going to be a pretty new experience for dealing with, you know, high availability functions. So what I thought that we would do for today's session is we would actually build our cluster from the ground up. Now, I understand that between the customer base that we've got on here, there's a variety of different approaches that we use for VM, high availability, shared storage, and stuff like that. And what I'm going to use today is I'm going to use an SMB3 target that I've got set up locally. Now, I didn't build it out as a scale-out file server cluster because I'm just doing this in my lab environment. But it's going to be something that's very, very easily repeatable for you guys for a small lab environment. That's why I like to actually demo this way, because you don't actually need any underlying shared storage. Now, when we look at the new advancements that are going to be coming for Windows Server 2016, we'll actually be able to build our own hyper-converged infrastructure using storage spaces direct from Microsoft, which is going to be a pretty interesting play, especially for some of the existing hyper-converged vendors that are out there. All right, so let's get rolling. I just want to do a quick poll of the audience before we get started here. If you could just respond with if you're using failover clustering or not right now, and if there's anything specific that you're hoping to get out, or if you have some gray areas around Windows failover clustering, go ahead and fire your questions into the chat, and as soon as I get a chance, I'll come back to them, and it gives me an idea as to what you guys are using, and a good group, a good idea for the group as well.
Awesome. Okay. So just a little bit about failover clustering and Microsoft's current support for this in Windows Server 2012 R2. In Windows Server 2012 R2, Microsoft supports up to 64 nodes in an individual cluster and up to 8,000 VMs. Now, in all reality, having that big of a cluster is going to be something that's going to be very difficult to manage. So I'm finding most of our production clients are going with between 4 to 8 node clusters typically. Even if they've got 16 nodes, they're going with smaller cluster sizes because they're a little easier to manage, patch, and maintain. Now, there's nothing that stops you from going larger. It's just, you know, this is just the way that they can be configured. Now, the cool part about the physical clusters that we use for Hyper-V is that they can be configured to use a variety of storage platforms under the covers. So what you guys are seeing right now in this slide in particular here, just go ahead and get my screen draw in here. Why is that not working for me today? Go use the other screen draw. Hold on. Come back here. Give me one sec. There we go. Okay, so the typical premise that Microsoft has for shared storage is using a shared SCSI 3 disk that supports what are called persistent reservations. And what we do in Hyper-V and failover clustering is we create this as what's called a cluster shared volume, or a CSV. And this is a very, very typical approach that that I find is used for a lot of customers. Now, the only requirement for this is you have to have something that's carving you up that SCSI 3 space. So you have to make sure that you have this SCSI 3 device that's actually going to be sharing those disks. So if this is a fiber channel SAN, you would have to zone out your LUNs, and you would have to make sure that you're taking and zoning out that LUN to all of these applicable hosts that you have. So there's a little bit of work under the covers to make sure that your underlying infrastructure ties into this properly. I know some of you are using technology from GridStore that automates the provisioning of a lot of this in a hyper-converged manner, and that's great. If you guys are Nutanix customers, for example, what they're doing is they're using something called SMB3. So they're creating basically a scale-out infrastructure, and they're attaching these virtual machines via a UNC path, okay? So it is a little bit different for each of you, but at the end of the day, the user interface that you see inside of failover clustering is going to be very similar. The coolest part about this is that, you know, with the ability to take and use SMB using scale-out file servers, using cluster shared volumes, taking and having a variety of different approaches, it makes the scalability of this particular solution with failover clustering from Microsoft and Hyper-V very resilient, robust, and basically agnostic, so that it'll work across a variety of different platforms. Some of the changes that came that Microsoft brought starting in 2008 R2 is that you could start to build your own failover clusters without having to take and have all of your hardware on what was called the HCL, or the hardware compatibility list. So in prior iterations of this, you actually fell outside of Microsoft support if you took and if you didn't use specific hardware that was actually cluster certified by Microsoft. So what they started to do, and I can't remember the exact date for this, but I know it came, I think it came around the 2008 timeframe, they started to let us do what I call build your own clusters. Now, the only thing that you have to do to maintain platform support from Microsoft is they perform a series of what are called validation tests. So prior to this cluster being allowed to stand up and being allowed to be built, They have a rigorous set of tests that go through and check things as far as your drivers, your firmware revisions, your Windows updates, your access to shared storage, to make sure that you're not going to inadvertently shoot yourself in the foot. Now, the rule of thumb for this is that those tests have to come across with basically a check mark. You cannot have any errors in those validation tests. And if you do, and you choose to proceed, you're operating with no support from Microsoft. So no MS help for your failover cluster. So it's actually really important that you actually pay attention when you're building your cluster and you do this properly. And as we go through and build our cluster, because I've torn down my environment and basically we're just going to start with a couple of plain old Hyper-V nodes when we go to build the cluster, I'm going to show you guys where those reports are, because in the event that you ever do have to phone Premier support, you're going to need to know where to locate those. Failover clustering support from Microsoft for its virtual IPs that are created fully supports IPv4 and V6, fully support the network teams provided by Microsoft. And as I mentioned earlier, you can attach your shared storage in a variety of different formats. Now, for the cluster shared volumes, this is a new feature that Microsoft had introduced that was only initially available for Hyper-V. And what this did is instead of taking this shared physical disk and locking it at the actual disk level on a per node basis so that we could only have one owner of this disk inside of the cluster, because I'll take a step back. In traditional clustering, guys, how this would normally work is you would take and you would add a shared disk component inside of the cluster UI, and this disk would only allow to be active on one particular node at a time. And then the other nodes would just sit as passive. And then what we could do is pass the baton of ownership from one to the other, but we could only ever have one owning that particular cluster resource at any given time. So what cluster shared volumes did was, instead of taking and allowing those locks to be held at the disk level, what they're held at is they're held at the individual folder level. So if I have a subfolder on this volume called VM1, and I have a subfolder on here called VM2, the locks are actually at this folder level. They're not at the actual drive level. What that means is that we can float around the ownership of these folders across the individual file system. And so this is actually a totally separate file system that Microsoft has written to support this. And now they've started to extend those capabilities, and they actually leverage the cluster shared volume file system for their storage spaces direct in Windows Server 2016. So they're continuing to expand on some of those enhancements that you have. So Carl had a very good question here, and Carl, I do like that question. So his question was, are scale-out file servers, the acronym for that, guys, if you don't know, is SOFS or SOFS. So our scale-out file server, SMB, and CSV, cluster shared volumes, mutually exclusive, i.e. needed to choose one or the other. And the answer for that, Carl, is you can actually choose either one. So, and you can use both inside of your cluster. So if you wanted to have a combination of scale-out file server VMs and cluster shared volume VMs, you could actually do that at the same time. There's nothing that precludes you from doing that inside of your cluster. So you could run one, you could run the other, or you could run both together, and they would happily function at the same time. So for example, I know, Carl, that you guys are currently running in a CSV, so you guys are using a CSV model. Let's say for whatever reason you ran out of space on that particular SAN that you guys were using, and you just needed to access something on a new target or spin up some new VMs on another storage platform, you could actually use SMB3 over a you could use SMB3 over a scale-up file server, or just attach to a standalone file server. It actually doesn't matter. The only thing you have to watch when you set it up with SMB3 is that you give the Hyper-V nodes the right permissions into that particular share. So you can think of us having to permission this as no different than having to go through and deal with the zoning or stuff like that. Okay. Great question, though. You don't actually, so Carl's second question was, you don't actually apply a CSV onto SMB storage. No, you don't. It's a totally different technique. So the SMB storage doesn't actually leverage the scale or the cluster shared volumes. And I think you can take in, if you use a scale-out file server, it might even use the CSV file system up above. It depends. So how I'm going to show you guys how to do this is I actually just have a standalone node that has a share, and that's how I'm going to target my VM. So you can have it inside of a cluster that sits on top, or you can just have a standalone server that lives there. All right. Good stuff. Good questions, guys. Keep them coming. All right, so now some of the constructs of the clusters. When you take and you build a failover cluster in a Microsoft world, the cluster nodes have to take and have to communicate with one another. So what we'll typically do is we'll typically create ourselves a VLAN for Heartbeat and live migration traffic. So this one here is the cluster communication traffic that we have. And this cluster communication traffic is typically going to be on a dedicated VLAN. So for argument's sake, I'm just going to say that this is going to be on something like VLAN 5. And this amount of traffic is very minimal that goes on back and forth between these individual nodes. And so the reason that these cluster nodes need to communicate with each other is they need to communicate to identify which resources are running on each of those independent nodes. And then we can actually turn on features inside of the cluster that will take and that will monitor stuff like resource levels. So for example, this particular host could have a checkbox turned on this particular VM that watches for service health or availability. And if something happens or something bad goes wrong with that, then we can have some remediation actions to say, oh, you know what, I want to move that particular virtual machine over here. But that traffic, that communication traffic, is actually going to occur between the nodes across this particular VLAN. Okay, so when we take and you build this out, you have to make sure that that's number one, that you take and you create that kind of that Heartbeat network. The second thing is that inside of the cluster, when you're talking about highly available virtual machines, all of the cluster nodes need access to the shared storage. Now, in the previous slide, we had talked about the different methods of providing that shared storage, either through a scale-out file server or a shared CSV, which is basically LUNs that are taken mapped directly to the multiple nodes. If you guys are VMware guys, the CSV concept is very similar to the way that we would do our VMFS volumes inside of VMware, where they can be shared between the different hosts. And so we just need to have access to that, okay? And so one of the things that we have to be really careful with failover clustering is if we lose communications over this particular network. So if something happens here and these nodes are no longer able to communicate with one another, what happens is our clusters themselves have a concept called a quorum. And what the quorum does is, if you can think of parliament or something like that, or your government, we have to have a majority of what are called votes, okay? So the votes inside of the cluster are going to take and determine which side comes online. So if something happens to your network and this gets severed, you have to watch that we don't get into something called a split brain scenario, where this side of the cluster thinks it's online and this side of the cluster thinks it's online, and it doesn't know where to actually place the resources. So typically what we'll do in a smaller cluster scenario is we can actually dedicate some additional shared storage as what's called a quorum drive or a witness. That's where our witness will live. And if you don't have shared storage for that component, you can actually run this even at a different site on a UNC path for your witness. Okay. And something that's brand new for 2016 is Microsoft has now included the capability of having a cloud-based witness. So if you want to take and if you want to run your witness in Azure, this is actually part of the new UI for failover clustering. So we don't have to have a reliance on one site or the other, and we can deal with our witnesses. Now, in failover clustering with Microsoft technologies, having a geographically dispersed cluster where we had half of our nodes on one side, half of our nodes on the other side, making sure that we had stuff like the third node for the witness was very important. Our third site for the witness was very, very important for us. For a lot of you that are running smaller clusters, you're probably just going to be running in some type of a shared disk. You'll probably see this inside of your cluster as like a queue drive, a shared queue drive inside of there. And that'll take and that'll provide capabilities for ensuring that you've got enough quorum and that you maintain all of the votes that are required to make the cluster healthy. Now, in the event that you guys do want to set up some geographically distributed clusters, there's some thresholds that you can define on this network. So for example, let's say that this is in building number one, and the second node is in building number two, or sorry, building number two. You can define something called the same subnet threshold on this cluster network. It's just a registry change that you can make. And it makes sure that if this network flaps for whatever reason, it doesn't just start killing your cluster and trying to move nodes over from one side to the other. Okay, so you can get into a few custom configurations like that. Yes, it is possible to do that. But at the end of the day, what you guys need to remember is that this cluster network that you have right here where the heartbeat runs, this needs to be a nice and healthy network. If it's not healthy, then I have a few things that we can do to tune that to make sure that it works. We can take these cluster nodes and we can run them at a single site. So we can have both of these running at a single location. I can geographically split those between multiple locations, but then you have to make sure that your shared storage is somehow replicated from one site to the other. Okay, so that's up to you to make sure that that's done. In Windows Server 2016, Microsoft is going to introduce a new concept for us that will introduce the ability to take this shared storage and use synchronous replication over to a second site that is now built right into Windows. So that will help with our geographically distributed clusters. Typically, how we see clusters built in today's day and age for a lot of customers, just to keep simplicity to utter maximums, is we will take this particular configuration at one site where we will have a cluster that's formed. And then, for example, at the DR site over here, if we have a DR location, there'll be a separate cluster that will be stood up at the other location. And so what we will do is we'll use some type of replication technology, either Hyper-V replica, or I know Veeam has some very good replication technologies. You could look at using something like the new Microsoft Azure Site Recovery or ASR to replicate the infrastructure between those particular data centers. And if you wanted to, this is also becoming very popular. Pardon my drawing of the cloud. We can also replicate that directly up to Microsoft using Azure Site Recovery. And a lot of customers are actually foregoing building that second DR site now, and they are just shipping everything directly to the cloud. I'm seeing this as becoming probably about, right now, for all the customers that I'm working with, this is probably becoming about 90% of customers are seriously looking at this right now because it's so much less headache for them to actually manage that second DR site. Just let it live in the cloud and online that stuff at some point in time when you want to. So a lot of different options that we have there, and each of your environments is going to be slightly different. Some are looking at this out of my customer base. Some have this set up right now for a dedicated DR site. Really depends on your data sovereignty and where you want these things to live long term. All right, so we're going to have to go build this and define this cluster communication network. So I want you to pay attention as we go through the demos, because we're going to have to define what networks are actually going to be running for cluster communications. So in today's session, what I have planned for us is we're going to actually stand up a two-node cluster. So I have two physical nodes that are ready to go, and we're going to have to go through these base configurations. So I've got some kind of best practices that we'll go through during my demo phase here. All right. Oh, it was an animated slide. Perfect. Okay, so talking a little bit about the quorums. And so as you can see inside of this, I talked a little bit in the previous slide about the quorum configuration. By default, the new technology that Microsoft has in 2012 R2 and 2016 is you can actually have a cluster dynamic quorum configuration. So if you take and if you lose a particular node or you lose two nodes, it will adjust your quorum model for you on the fly, okay? And so this was introduced in 2012 and is carrying on into 2012 R2. The rule of thumb for this is that you can never have an even number of votes. I have to have majority. And in order for me to achieve a majority, I have to have odd numbers inside of my cluster. So the number one is good. So I can have a single node cluster because that one vote will always win. In a two node cluster, we're even and they don't know who's going to win. So we actually have to introduce a third vote to that. This is called a witness, or this witness can be on shared storage. This witness can be on a UNC path called a file share witness. And it can now be on a cloud-based witness in something like Microsoft Azure Shared Storage. That is a new feature in the UI that's been introduced in 2016. If you lose quorum, guys, and you have issues with quorum, I'm not sure if any of you have ever experienced this before. What happens if you start to lose quorum? So if you start to lose quorum, you're going to have a split brain in your cluster. Some of your nodes are going to go down. They're not going to know how to behave. And this is the symptom that you're going to see. These guys are not going to have very much fun onlining themselves, okay? Until the cluster is nice and healthy and it says, yep, we can actually bring those resources online. So you can actually get yourself into kind of an ugly little timeout situation for your cluster where nothing will actually come online. So it is actually pretty important that you pay attention to, you know, what that node majority model actually looks like and how you're going to design and build that for your clusters. Now, if you're running smaller clusters, it's not necessarily that big of a deal. If you're running single site clusters, it's not necessarily that big of a deal. Where you run into problems is when you want it to do stuff like this. I wanted to run two nodes at site A. I wanted to run two nodes at site B. That's when you have to be extremely careful. And so very, very few of my customers actually do that right now because of the issues that if this network flaps, if something goes up and down, both sides don't know how to turn on. So what they do is they segment this out and they carve it up. So this is not necessarily in all entirety a Microsoft best practice, but my best practice is if you want to have two sites, you create two different clusters, you have two different sets of shared storage, and you use some type of replication technology to get the data back and forth, because I can get you within, you know, a 15-second window between the two sites with even using native technologies. All right. Has anybody ever experienced the loss of quorum before in their cluster? Just go ahead and type in the chat if you have. If you haven't, just say no, and trying to keep it nice and interactive here for you guys. All right, so one of the different cluster models that you have is called a node majority. And so you see these in the UI options. So once again, I want you guys to pay attention to some of these different pieces of terminology that you have, because when I go to configure our quorum, you can have what's called a node majority. And a node majority doesn't require any shared storage. Great for single site, and it'll just adjust based on the fact of how many nodes you actually have inside of your cluster. Does not require any access to shared storage. So if you don't have shared storage for your cluster, not a problem. You can use node majority. Where we see stuff like this, node majority and file share witnesses, is very, very popular in Exchange 2010 clusters. So any of my customers that are on the line and I built your Exchange clusters with your DAGs or your database availability groups, we actually use what's called the file share witness for this for this extra vote that we have, and we actually don't use a node majority. Okay. All right. So your cluster networking that you have, so this has remained the same for quite some time. You're typically going to want to set up a minimum of four networks. I talked a little bit about this in the earlier sessions. And so when we take and we build those cluster networks, you're typically going to have one network that's called host management. Typically, I'll just create this as what I call when I build these as my MGMT or my management network. And this is what we're going to use to actually connect into the Hyper-V hosts themselves. And we'll manage the actual Windows OS that runs on the Hyper-V host itself. You'll typically have a VM access network or networks, and this will be particular VLANs that'll be presented for all of your VMs that are running. And this can be carved out on a per VM basis. Normally what I recommend to my customers is when they set up the VLAN that's going to be used for VM access, that if they've got a default server VLAN, so if they have a server VLAN, I typically recommend that you set that as your default VLAN. That way you don't actually have to define all the VLANs on each of the VMs as you go. Some of you want to type in the VLAN IDs every time you build a VM to get them on the outside world, that's fine. That just gets to be a little bit of a pain, especially if you're always on a flat or segmented network. So this particular VLAN is something that I'll take and I'll present and pass through from my VM network. And this VM access network would actually run on your virtual switch. So we saw this the other day when we created the networking, that we'll create a virtual switch 01 or 02. That's where this is going to actually run through. That's where that traffic will run through. The next dedicated VLAN that you're going to want to have is you're going to want to have a dedicated VLAN so that we can run live migrations of the virtual machines between each of the respective hosts that we have. The faster the network you have for this, the better. And remember what we learned yesterday about the 3 to 5 gigabit rule, right? So the maximum amount of traffic that you're going to get on those converged Ethernet switches from Microsoft in 2012 R2 is 3 to 5 gigabit, depending on the speed of your processor, right? So even if I have a 10 gig backplane here and I'm running a converged network, the maximum speed I'll get for that file transfer on my live migrations is between 3 to 5 gigabit. Last one's cluster communications, and then you can also have an optional storage. This is only really required if you're going to be running iSCSI or SMB. If you're directly presenting that via fiber channel or something else, then you won't really require that network. I just normally call the fiber channel network that same one. All right. Okay, so I think we're going to stop here on the PowerPoints, and what I'm going to do is we're going to actually go and jump over to my lab environment that I've got, and let me just get a couple hosts queued up that I can RDP into here. All right, so I've got my first host. Let's just minimize all of this good and wonderful stuff that we've got. Close. If any of you have worked with me, you know that this is my typical server that I jump onto. I'll normally leave like a million windows open as I'm working through stuff. Awesome. Okay, so there we've got one host there. And so what we're going to do is we're going to actually configure this initial host. So this particular host that we have that we're going to be working on, although it's running on Windows Server 2016, this is basically just a Hyper-V host. And so this Hyper-V host that we have has had a couple things that we've done to it. Number one is we have installed the Hyper-V role. And to install the Hyper-V role, if you guys aren't familiar with how to install that Hyper-V role, and I just want to touch base on something real quick here, because Chad from the Yavapai IT team actually pointed something out to me in the first session, that the type of hypervisor that is run For this is actually going to be a Type 2 hypervisor for Microsoft. So although it installs as a role, this actually has an abstraction layer around the hardware. It's almost like installing and laying down another image that enables the Hyper-V role on your particular host themselves. It's not what you would typically know as like a Type 1 hypervisor, which would be like a VMware workstation or a virtual server or something like that. This is actually a full Type 2 hypervisor. So we've installed that role. Now, if you don't know where to install that role, I'm just going to quickly show you where it is, because some of you on the call may have never actually had a chance to do this before. So let's go ahead and open up our server manager. This is the same on 2012 as it is on 2012 R2. Clear my screen drawing. And we're just going to go add remove roles. Next. You can do this all through PowerShell as well too. And it's right here. Just so you guys see, there's just a Hyper-V role. You just select this. And when you install this, I know I didn't demo the actual install of this, and there's a reason for that, because it takes like 2 reboots to actually get this done, and I don't want to have to actually go through and do that. So you just go next, 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 finish. Do not configure the virtual switches, because it asks you if you want to do that, so don't configure anything. Just next, 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 finish. Let it reboot twice, and your hypervisor will be ready to go for you. The second thing that I installed on here was failover clustering. So I just checked the box for failover clustering. That's it, guys. I have done nothing else to these nodes, just added these 2 things. And the rule of thumb that you have is on your Hyper-V host server itself is you want these things to be as skinny as possible, okay? So, yes, Chad, I guess I got those backwards. So Type 1 and Type 2. So Type 1 hypervisor like vSphere, Type 2 like the desktop one. So when we take and configure these things, you want to keep your Hyper-V hosts as absolute skinny as possible. The reason you want to keep these things as skinny as possible is that if these things blow up, I actually find that probably 95% of my customer base does not back up these hosts. So there's no backup on the actual hosts themselves, because they have some way, shape, or form of automation that they could get this thing back up and running in 1 hour or less. And in 1 hour or less, I'm not really worried about it, because if I'm running highly available virtual machines, these are just going to pass over to another one of the Hyper-V hosts in the event that something has blown up on this guy. So I won't really see a huge service outage. My VMs will be back up online. I get a chance to take this hardware here, I can replace it, and I can bring this guy back up online, and I have this typically installed and up and running and ready to go in less than an hour on a typical Hyper-V host. So it's up to you guys whether or not you're going to be backing this stuff up or not, but most of my customers don't. So that's one of the goals, even with going through the operational stuff, is you're going to get a lot of stuff that's really outside the curriculum and outside of, you know, what you're going to be able to find kind of online, right? Okay, so that's it. So that's all we're dealing with here. So once this is done, what we can do is we can actually stand up our failover cluster, okay? So before we stand up our failover cluster, I want to just show you a couple things. Number one is Hyper-V can actually be run in what's called a hybrid mode, okay? So this hybrid mode actually allows you to run HA VMs and non-HA VMs on the same host. And I know that it can seem potentially a little bit confusing for you, but these ones here are going to have all of the cluster components, right? Get out of here. All my cluster components. And these guys here are just going to be regular Hyper-V manager. Okay? So what I want to do here is I just want to quickly create a virtual machine with you. And the virtual machine is just going to be via Hyper-V manager. And then what we're going to do is we're going to stand up our cluster. And then I'm going to show you how you can take these non-HA VMs and migrate them into the cluster. And then I want to show you how we can take these HA VMs and migrate them out of the cluster and bring them back into a standalone fashion. There's a multitude of reasons why we would want to do that, because in the event that we're decommissioning this particular cluster, or we want to migrate from one cluster to another, so let's say that we've got one cluster, this is running on a certain piece of hardware, maybe this thing was bought in circa, let's say that this was bought in like 2012, and we wanted to introduce a brand new Hyper-V cluster over here that was bought in 2017, and we want to take and have this as a totally separate cluster. I don't want it as part of this one. I want to just be able to migrate things out. Well, Microsoft doesn't actually provide you the ability to take an out-of-box migrate from one cluster to another without using some type of replication technology to do this, okay? So we can still get away with this by doing something called a shared nothing live migration, but I have to ditch the highly available VM from cluster one, bring it into a standalone VM. It's like one click to do it. And then I can actually do a live migration over to the new cluster over here. And I can actually achieve this through a process. And I've actually tested and defined this with zero outage downtime. So there's zero downtime that's going to actually be required to migrate cluster to cluster. There's just a little bit of a process that you have to follow. So I do have a method to my madness as to why I want to show you how to do these things in a particular fashion here, okay? All right, so let's go ahead and just do a quick review on our single host. One of the cool things, I think, let's make sure I'm on actual right host. So yesterday, yep, so this is the guy that we configured the networking on yesterday. So if you guys remember from yesterday's session, we stood up all of our particular networks here, right? Now, one of the things that we didn't do is we didn't actually put IP addresses on these particular networks, okay? So the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm just going to jump into the virtual Ethernet adapters, and I'm going to say that VLAN 5 is going to be on an IP subnet range of 1.1.1.1. Actually, check that. That's actually a bad idea because I actually had some customers do that in production. I did it in a demo and they're like, well, you said to do 1.1.1.1, which is actually a public IP space. So what we're going to do is we're going to create this one here as a 172.16. Was the VLAN I had that we were going to use. We say 5.0/24. And this one here will be 172.16.6.0/24, so a 255 subnet mask. So let me just go quickly define these, okay, because we forgot to do that yesterday. So we'll go and just quickly set our IP addresses on here. This is an important prerequisite because the actual cluster configuration UI can only see one subnet at a time, so it actually won't show these network adapters if they're not configured properly. So 172.16.5.1, 255 mask, no gateway, doesn't matter. And we'll just set this one here as a 172.16.6.1, 255 mask. Next, okay, perfect. Another little tidbit that I will typically do, guys, before I build the cluster is I normally have a post-install folder, and I'll normally do something like this, ipconfig, and then I will take ipconfig/all, and I'll pipe that out to a /ipconfig.txt. Because why? Because I want to actually have that output saved. Now I've got all my IP addresses nicely saved for me. Okay. Did it bind my IP addresses? 172, 5.1, 6.1. And then I've got the other IP addresses in there from these guys. Perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect. And I do have a couple of different adapters that are in here. They're going to be on the same network because if you remember, my prod team, I only ever did add one adapter inside of there. Okay, so now that we've got that set up, let's go into Hyper-V Manager. And what we're going to do is we're going to create ourselves our first virtual machines. So what I want to show you for the lab configuration that we have right now is in the lab config, I have a D drive on this particular server. It's got a VMs folder, But what I did to show and to show you how I'm going to do the SMB3 functionality here is I just created a share for this called VM's dollar sign, and I just set the sharing permissions on here. Now I didn't isolate this. I just added a couple things, and I can give you a document if you want to play around with the SMB3 functions. You just basically have to have the computer accounts and stuff like that added in so that Hyper-V can talk into this folder and create VMs. And the reason that I'm doing this is just because I didn't have all of the shared storage available as of yet. So what I'm going to do here is just go ahead and create a new virtual machine. The new virtual machine I'm going to create is going to be called SMB test number one. I'm just going to store this in a little bit of a weird location. Now, technically speaking, I could go and store it on D:\VMs, but if the other node doesn't have a D drive presented, that's going to be a bit of a problem for me. So I'm just going to share this over a UNC path, so TCHQVS01, and this could be also, I think Carl was asking about the softs, so this could be your softs front end cluster that you'd built if you wanted to, /VMs dollar sign is going to be the actual path. Click Next, Gen 2. None of this stuff here actually matters from the configuration standpoint because I just want to prove that I can actually just build a virtual machine. And go ahead and click Next and Finish. And there we go. And then if we want to make sure that that'll actually power on, going across that SMB share. And so now what you guys are looking at right now is this particular virtual machine. Obviously, nothing's going to happen with it because it's actually not ready for being available and viable on the network. Actually, you know what I think I can do? I think I have a WDS server running on this network. So let's just go ahead and reset this. And I'm actually just going to start an install going on this while we're doing everything else. So let's let that go ahead and reboot itself. Let that go ahead and reboot itself, turning off because I'm super, super impatient. Okay, so this is actually just booting off of my WDS server, and we're just going to let this go ahead and start the process of doing an install. Now, guys, the coolest part about this, and the reason why I wanted to show you this, is a lot of people think that running SMB Hyper-V is a bad idea or, you know, you can't do this. It's super easy to set up. And this is all just running over a UNC path that's leveraging SMB3 technology. This is probably the easiest way to set up, manage, and maintain Hyper-V. And the performance of this is actually pretty decent. So if I take and I come in here, I'd set a temp server set up. I'm just going to start the install just so I can get some load running on here. Win7. I haven't even renamed my WDS server D36 because I love typing in names like this live. And let's just say that we want to dump down like Win10 Pro to this or something. Perfect. So now I have some load running on this, but remember that how I'm connecting and attaching to this is just over SMB3. It provides some very, very interesting options, especially as we attempt to extend this out from a failover clustering perspective. So let's just let this run. I'm going to minimize this. I'm going to minimize this. We got a little bit of load running on there. I just wanted to show you guys a couple things. So now we want to turn that into a highly available VM. So what you can see inside of here right now, it's kind of weird because there's no actual term inside of here that will tell you that this is a highly available VM, so an HA VM or a non-HA VM. Non-HA VM. Okay, inside of Virtual Machine Manager with System Center, it does show you that. There's actually a checkbox for this. I actually had to show a colleague this this week. And then inside of the Failover Cluster Manager, what will end up happening is there's nothing really in there either. So the core guts of the hypervisor live inside of this tool. So wherever those resources are running and are being consumed, this is what you can consider kind of your layer one or kind of your level one Hyper-V management tool. So I'll just call this number one, is called your Hyper-V manager. So in the event that something happens and your tiers that you have above this, because the next one that we're going to look at is going to stack another kind of management layer over on top of this, which is called failover cluster manager. So failover cluster manager, and this is going to kind of be a layer two, and then a layer three later on is going to be your system center virtual machine manager. Okay, so this right here is always going to be your friend. This guy right here is always going to tell you the truth. There's no other management interfaces that come in inside. However, if you are going to use highly available VMs, this is the tool you're normally going to come into. If you're doing like troubleshooting and stuff like that, it's going to be failover clustering, because you lose the ability to take and see kind of what's happening, and these VMs will just appear and disappear. So for example, if I had a bunch more nodes that were showing up inside of here and I was doing live migration, this particular VM would actually disappear from here and would show up in the UI on one of these other nodes, whichever one it was attached to. But it's still neat to actually see the underpinnings under the covers. And this is where you can actually see the guts of what's actually happening inside of Hyper-V, okay? All right, so let's go ahead and let us build ourselves our very first cluster. And so for those of you that are on Windows Server 2012 R2, the building of the cluster process is super, super easy. You can build it in like one line of PowerShell, or you can just go into the failover cluster manager tool, right? Because remember, I showed you there was that one feature I added, which was failover cluster manager. The second feature that I added was Hyper-V. So this is what allowed us to stand this up. So we stood up our networking, we've got our core hypervisor running. I've proven that we can get standalone VMs running. Now we want to do some highly available VMs. Now the cool part about standing this up is that inside of the failover cluster manager, what you can do is you can actually stand up what are called single node clusters. So I can actually run a one node cluster just to get this set up and prove things out. I could take and I could build this with two nodes at a time. I could build this with 10 nodes at a time, or I could build this with up to 64 nodes at a time. Any numbers in between. You just choose how many nodes you want to activate and build through. But as you're learning this for the very first time, if you just wanted to stand this up in a dev environment or just play around with failover clustering, the only thing you wouldn't be able to do if you had a single node cluster is you wouldn't be able to play around with some of the high availability features, because I need a minimum of what are called two nodes for that, right? So this is what we're going to have built at the end of our session today. We'll have a two node cluster up and running. And we'll kind of just be reinforcing these concepts as we go through. Okay, so the first thing that we have to do is let's just do a little walk down through the UI console. So on the right-hand side of the failover clustering tool, you've got an action pane, you've got a detail pane. It's a very, very typical Microsoft Management Console. Now, the one area that you have to pay really particular attention to is that there's a clusters section, there's also a management section. So it's kind of a hidden area down here, right here, that after we stand up the cluster, we're going to actually have to pay attention to this screen of this part of the GUI after we actually build this out, okay? So I'll show you that afterwards, but you'll see, because it kind of hides it in the UI by default. So let's go ahead and let's build our first cluster. So what are a couple of the things that we need to build our cluster? It's really only three or four steps that are required for us to get this built properly. Number one is you have to take and you have to have a NetBIOS name and a DNS name for the cluster, because it creates a virtual IP and a cluster name object, CNO, cluster name object, that need to be defined as part of the build process of this cluster. Number two, you need to give me an IP address on the management network, okay? So you'll hear me when I come on site to your organization, I'm like, okay, I need a name and I need an IP because I got to build the cluster. It's because the cluster is going to create that virtual IP space. Number three, after we get this set up, we have to have that shared storage, or we have to have the ability to connect to that SMB3 space. So we need to have the ability to have shared storage, Or if we're using SMB3, we need to make sure that all of those permissions are set up properly. Those of you that are on the Nutanix platform, you have to actually go into Prism. What of a P is that? All right, there you go, going to Prism, and you actually have to whitelist these servers. So there's a process that you have to use to, in order to use the SMB3, you have to actually go through and whitelist those bad boys. All right, let's go build this guy. Enough talking, let's actually do some stuff. So first thing we're gonna do is we're gonna go through and we're gonna say, create ourselves a cluster. The other thing you can do, guys, you can actually manage multiple clusters from this failover clustering tool. You can also take and do this from a jump box. So for example, a lot of you will have a shared RDS server or something with all your management tools. If you loaded the failover cluster manager into your RDS server, your jump box, you could actually connect to multiple clusters if you had them in here. So you could have your DR cluster, you could have your RDS cluster, you could have your production cluster. You could be able to connect to all of those at the same time. Okay, so let's go ahead and create the cluster. So interestingly enough, this is one of those pieces that a lot of people only ever set up once. I had a really interesting session last week with the guys over at Teravita, and they were saying, well, our VMware farm that we have is pretty big. Like, we got like, I don't know, what you guys have, like 30 hosts in VMware or something like that. And you're like, we only built that cluster once. We actually haven't touched it in 2 to 3 years. Probably don't even really remember all the steps that are kind of required to go through and build that. So it's kind of a good refresher to actually be able to see how this stuff gets stood up from scratch, because normally only one person will do the driving and the formation of the cluster, and then somebody else will be using it and managing it. So it's good from an operational standpoint to see what's going on. Okay, so my little tip and trick number one is when you're building this cluster, TCHQVS01 is the name of my cluster, I'll always actually type this in via the NetBIOS name because I want to make sure that it actually resolves to the FQDN. So we'll go ahead and add. If, guys, if this does not resolve to the FQDN, do not pass go. Cancel, go fix your DNS issues, because if you have DNS issues, this will never work. Okay? Go fix those now before you take and proceed on, because it's just your cluster is never going to operate properly. So if you had two of these servers that showed up and one that didn't, go fix your DNS problems, because there's something underlying under the covers there. All right, go ahead and click next. So the next thing that we want to do is we want to say yes to the validation. So it's saying, hey, are you sure that that you want to take and do this? And the answer is yes, absolutely, because if you read the fine print here, Microsoft supports a cluster solution only if the complete configuration of server, storage, and networks can pass the validation wizard. And if you say no to this, it'll actually say, are you sure you? I don't require support from Microsoft here? So do you think they've taken a few support calls on that to actually build that directly into the UI? Yeah, I think so. Now, because I only have a single node, and I don't actually have a ton of shared storage, not much is going to actually fail, because there's not going to be much to like arbitrate to go through. And so I can click next, and you can say yes, run all tests. I'm going to say run only selected tests just to show you what the UI wizard looks like here. This is one that you guys won't see because this is new for Server 2016, which is the Storage Spaces Direct, which is the Microsoft Hyperconverged. So you won't see that on your 2012s. You're only going to see the configuration, inventory, network storage, and system configuration. Okay, so that's going to be a new one for you. So we'll go ahead and do that. Now, the other really important thing is that if you guys have, and I'm building some clusters with the guys at a couple sites right now, in your networking control panel, if you have a couple of these adapters that have like the red X through them, you know what I'm talking about. Like if the adapters aren't connected, they're gonna look like this. They're gonna have that little red X through them. Make sure that you take these adapters and you disable them before running this test, okay? Oh, that didn't draw very good. There was a little bit of jitter. Make sure that you actually go ahead and you disable those, because otherwise this test will fail. Okay, let's go ahead and click next. Go ahead and click next. This will just take a moment to go through. Coolest part about this is that if you do have shared storage and you open up disk management while this is going through, disk management, what'll end up happening is your shared drives that you have. So like, let's say that all of these drives that I had in here were like, these were all LUNs that were passed through from my fiber channel SAN. You'll actually see them onlining and offlining themselves in here as it's trying to arbitrate them going through these tests. Because you can see that it's going through and it's doing tests in here about shared storage, shared disks, all of this stuff. Now, in my instance, everything looks good. Everything appears to be validated. So we can actually click on View Report. And this is an amazing source of documentation for your guys' networks. So if you're looking to ever see how your clusters were built and stuff like that, you can actually go ahead and save off this report, and it has tons of amazing information. Like, for example, here's my BIOS versions of each of the nodes. And every node that you ran the test on here would actually show in here. So if you're looking for complete and comprehensive documentation for your environments, this is here. It's built in. And sometimes if I'm walking in cold into an environment and oopsie-daisy, I click close on that, this is actually stored in this location, C drive, Windows, cluster, reports, okay? And so this will give me a ton of really cool information on what's being built. So for example, you can see that I've got a cluster validation report that's been run at 103 Pacific time. So 203, is that what it is right now? So 203 Mountain time. And I can just go reopen this report. And so if I'm ever looking to see IP ranges, network configurations, adapters, BIOS levels, HBAs, any of that stuff, I got it all right here. So you can just have that for some of your as-built documentation. Super cool, right? And then I was doing some other stuff playing around on here earlier with enabling storage spaces direct on my cluster here. So we can see that, oh, well, I went to go enable storage spaces direct and it found these particular drives inside of here. And we can see that it wanted to do something with those, right? So then I created, this was the actual creation of the cluster wizard. So I created the cluster once already, and this is the actual step-by-step stuff that it went through to build and formulate my cluster. So I'm gonna call my cluster S2D-CLU1, because I'm actually gonna use storage spaces direct inside of my cluster at a later point in time. And because I am running DHCP, and those adapters that we're actually connecting to are built running DHCP, I'm not actually going to see an IP addressing screen. So if I come over to my prod team here, VLAN 1, that's where the virtual switch was created. And if I come down here, you see how I'm actually running DHCP on that adapter? So the cluster wizard actually knows that I'm running DHCP. So it says, hey, I see you're running DHCP. So we're just going to set the cluster virtual IP. So the virtual IP that's created, we're just going to set this to DHCP by default. If this was set to a static IP address, then it would actually prompt me for an IP address here. So if you're wondering why that never prompted me for the IP address, it's just because I have this entire farm set to DHCP. So I go ahead and I click next. I go ahead and I click next. And I know, guys, you're looking at this right now with the formulation of this cluster, and you're saying, wow, that was pretty hard. That was like six clicks and you're done. Well, in all honesty, it is six clicks and you're done. Now, you remember I don't have any shared storage available for the witness or the quorum, so it just set it to a node majority, all right? It took and set a DHCP range in here, and this is the actual name of my cluster. So a couple of things that you're going to do to test this to make sure that all of this is up and running properly is I actually created a new name here, ping S2D-CLU, what did I call it, 01 or 1? 1, okay? And I should actually be able to ping this. Click in here. And this should actually be resolvable for me. I might have to do it by... hasn't fully registered that name yet. Hasn't replicated in Active Directory yet. So as soon as this comes online, I'm just going to show you something here. Remember how I told you you had to look down a little bit here into the core resources section? So if I expand this out, it actually got an IP address of 10.10.50.4. And the actual Active Directory computer account name is called S2DCLU1. So ping S2DCLU1, And this should actually resolve for me. I don't know why you're not resolving. You might have to do a flush DNS or something. ipconfig/flushdns. All right. Open an elevated command prompt. Thing. Yes. Thing is to be clu1. Just hasn't replicated yet. So that's a pingable artifact. So I should actually be able to ping this IP address here as well too. So let's try that. So let's go ping 10.10.50.4 and see how I can ping the IP address at least. So as soon as my AD replication kicks in, and that's actually an important one. If you're in a larger environment, your AD replication can take a little while for this to actually spin up, okay? So the next thing that we're going to take a look at for the actual building of this cluster, and there's probably going to be at least 1 to 2 sessions or more on the actual cluster UI on this interface, because there is actually quite a bit that you can do inside of here. What we're going to do is we're going to take and just take a look at what the actual user interface of this looks like. So under the cluster configuration, now that I've actually got this built out, this is our first failover cluster that's built. This is actually ready for Hyper-V out of the box. I don't have to do anything else. I can build highly available VMs in this right now. And so all of your Hyper-V virtual machines actually show up in this node here called roles. Okay? Your Hyper-V host servers themselves will show up under nodes. The attached storage, whatever you've got, if you're using shared storage, will show up here, and your networks will show up here. So I've got a couple of housekeeping items that I always do before taking and before kind of moving on and proceeding and doing much else. The first very thing I do is I go check my networks. And you can see in here that I have something called Cluster Network 1, Cluster Network 2, Cluster Network 3. Now, if you guys remember, I set some specific IP addresses on these, right? And so my specific IP addresses that I had set on these were on those ranges, 172.16.6, 172.16.5, and 10.10. Now, remember, if I had left those all on DHCP, I would have only have seen one network in here, because it only shows the one network. The other thing that it does is it will only ever take and show the adapters that are actually bound inside of there. So on 2012 R2, I think it'll only show one adapter at a time. In 2016, it'll show both of my adapters here. So what I like to do for some housekeeping inside of here, just because when I go to do my documentation of this later on, is I'm going to want to match and pair some of these names. So for example, do you see how in my PowerShell build script, I named this Heartbeat Live Migration on VLAN 6? So if I come up to here, just pull this over so that you guys can see that. So which one is this? This is on VLAN 5, and that's 172.16.5. So I want to rename this, guys. So I'm going to take this, and I'm going to actually match the name that I have here. So I think that was .5, so VLAN 5. Boom. Make sense? Properties. Modify this. This is going to be my, did I name that wrong? Heartbeat Live Migration was 6. Sorry, I have that wrong. So this one here is actually my Heartbeat, and this is going to be on VLAN 6. And this guy here was my Live Migration on VLAN 5. And this guy here is my Management-VLAN 1. This does not happen automatically. So basically what's going to happen if I have to go and dump the cluster configuration, now these settings that I have here are going to match everything that I have inside of my configuration that I have here. That doesn't happen by default, and those default names mean absolutely nothing to me, okay? So it's not going to help me out at all. Okay, so the next thing that we're going to do here is I'm just going to show you storage. Now, because I don't have a SAN that's directly connected in here yet, if I go to hit add disks, it's going to pop up an error message, and the error message is going to say, sorry, no disk suitable for cluster were found because there's nothing that's actually set with a shared disk reservation. So unless I enable storage spaces direct pool and I configure this, I'm not going to actually see any of this. So the interesting point to this is that when you set up an SMB3, so if you guys are doing SMB3 Hyper-V clusters, and I'm attaching, let's say that I've got my Hyper-V node number one, this is my Hyper-V node number one, and I'm actually just attaching over the network /// server2/VMs $, and this is actually mapping over to another server over here, you actually don't use this section at all. You don't even have to go in here. So basically, all of the storage functions are outside of this cluster, and all that you're using is high availability and compute and memory resources off of these hosts and any of the other shared features and functionality. So it kind of creates a little bit of a scale-out methodology for you. So if I click on my roles here, let's go ahead and build our very first virtual machine. So I can see that I've got one node in my cluster. And inside of my cluster, we want to build our first test virtual machine, highly available virtual machine. Now, remember, it's not really highly available yet because we don't have anything to make this to work with yet. So I'm just going to call this HAVM1. I'm going to change the path, right? So I'm going to change the path here to /// my file share, which happens to be this node, but that's fine. TCHQVS01/VMs$. Gen 2, none of the rest of this matters, 4096, whatever, connect to the network, sure, no problem, installation options, I'm just going to move that to finish, and you'll see a little bit of a different screen that's going to pop up here. It's going to say configuring high availability, okay? And so what that did is that actually brought this cluster object into the, this object into the cluster. But you notice in here, I'm going to pull something up for you. I want to show you something, and I just want to do a compare and contrast of Hyper-V Manager for you. So if I pull up Hyper-V Manager, whoa, wait a minute. In Hyper-V Manager, I actually see more stuff. So in Hyper-V Manager, in the standalone fashion, I see this VM, and this VM, and this is the only one here that I just created that actually matches up. Interesting. All right. Well, let's see where that's going to lead us here. So I'm just going to go ahead and turn on this virtual machine for giggles. Just pull this over. It's really handy when you're learning this, guys, to just keep these windows open together, because then you can kind of really get the feel of what this is going to look like. Okay? Because it kind of reinforces that concept of the different layers of management tools that we have. So what we're going to do is we're just going to turn on this virtual machine. As soon as I turn on that virtual machine, look what happened over here. Now, something that's very, very important for all of you, especially if you're troubleshooting, do you notice how I have a particular tab or a particular column that's missing from Failover Cluster Manager? I'm missing status. So if for whatever reason, this particular VM is stuck doing something, and there's like a percentage thing that's happening here for a job or an action, this thing here looks like it's hung inside of this UI. And it just says pending, pending, pending. You have no idea actually what's going on. That's because there's something that's happening down here under status. Okay? So there's a very good reason why I'm showing you the two UIs like this, because normally if somebody just hands you this over, they'll be like, okay, here's a document, go through, here's failover clustering. No, this is operationalization. You guys need to understand where these moving parts are actually coming from, right? Okay, so now the next thing I want to show you is, let's say that we don't want this VM in the cluster anymore. So let's say that I don't want this guy inside of the cluster anymore, and I want to just move him back to a standalone VM. You right-click on here, on the VM, you click remove. This does not delete anything. This just removes it from the failover cluster. I say yes. My role is gone. You see how it's actually still running here? Nothing happened to the VM. The VM is actually still live. I'll turn it off. Turn it on. It's a standalone VM. I'll get into the Pixie bootloader just so that we can see something happening here. Okay, so the VM is like building. It's doing something here, right? So let's just go ahead and shrink you down. It's here. Right, so this guy's doing something. Something's happening to him. just going to shrink this screen over a little bit just so that you can see kind of what's going on here. So something's happening in that VM. Oops. How do I bring that VM into the cluster now? So there's some screen here, Windows deployment, blah, blah, blah. Now, here's how easy it is to actually bring this VM into the cluster. So I go configure role, click next. There's an option down here for virtual machine. Click next. Oh, okay. And I see that I had that SMB test one, and this guy here was actually built using shared storage. So he's actually a good candidate. So the only rule of thumb is if you want to bring something into the cluster, it has to be leveraging shared storage. So if it's in a shared storage component, this will work. These other two are actually stored on the local disk. So I don't believe that they'll actually work. I may have built them shared. I don't remember. I was just kind of playing around. So I go ahead and click next, and it'll say, oh, making me highly available. Thank you very much. There's your two VMs. All right. Now they're actually part of the cluster here. Now, once they're inside of the cluster, then I can start doing stuff like live migration techniques. So I can't live migrate to anything right now because I only have the one node inside of the cluster. But if I right-click on that VM, there's different options in here. I can go to do stuff like settings. Oh, wow, this looks just like my Hyper-V settings that I would see from Hyper-V Manager. So I right-click on settings. I can add network adapters. I can add processors, memory, all the generic stuff. If I right-click on here, I can see settings. It's the same view. Now, when you have a highly available VM and you modify settings, the configuration actually needs to be shared amongst all the nodes. So when you make this change, this is actually being modified on this particular server, but this configuration set and these files need to be actually merged between all of the different nodes. So if I had nodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that configuration information needs to be shared. So whenever you have an HAVM, always use the settings function from within here, okay? So always want to make sure you do that. So I got about 10 minutes left. I think we're still doing pretty good for time. Good demo heavy session again here today. And so now what I want to do is I actually want to add the second node into my cluster. So what I'm going to do here is let me just see. Oops, that back up for a sec. I just want to see if I can ping the second node here. So ping tchqvs02. Great, I can ping it. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to open up a separate RDP window here. And I just have I forgot to configure the network adapters, and I have to put the IP addresses on this other node here real quick. So tchqvs02. Let me just log into this guy. I know you can't see it because I'm on my other screen, but that's fine. You'll see another RDP window jump in here in 2 seconds. Okay, so this is my second node that I have here, guys. This guy's already joined to the domain. Everything's kind of good to go on him. But the problem is that I haven't configured any of the networking on this guy yet. So what we have to do is just a real quick recap. I have to just rerun my PowerShell script, set up my team real quick, and then this guy will be good to go to come into the cluster. So it's actually a really good refresh of everything that we did on node one yesterday. And a lot of this process of going through and doing this is really a rinse and repeat after you get the hang of it. And I know that, you know, I have one of my really, really good customers on the call here today, Scott. They actually do all of the builds 100% of their Hyper-V nodes themselves. I think I worked with them on maybe their first 5 or 7 nodes and showed them how to do it, and we kind of worked together through it. They built like 30 or 40 on their own now, okay? And they're having great success. They never really have issues with, you know, their Hyper-V host servers because they follow a very very prescriptive process to actually build this stuff out properly. So this is the new node that I want to add to the cluster. So I'm just going to show you. It just has 2 network adapters. It has the plain Jane configuration that we started with on the other one. I just have to see what I was binding in through here. I don't want to kick myself off this box. 10, 10, 240, 64. And I've got 10, 10, 240, 59. Normally what I do when I configure this is I'll come in through out-of-band management. So the first thing I'm going to do here is I'm just going to enable that Windows team. And for those of you that are new on the call today that hadn't sat the other calls for the previous two sessions, we went through in detail the networking stack on the previous two sessions. So if you're looking for a refresher, just watch video number two on this. So we're going to call this, remember guys, prod team. Choose that adapter, switch independent. Hopefully this doesn't punt my RDP session here. Looks like it punted my RDP session. Come on, back online now. Actually gives itself, there we go. I actually picked the NIC that I was working with. So what's going to end up happening is I'm actually just going to select both NICs because I already chose the one that I was working in, that I was bound in through. So we'll throw both NICs into the mix for this one. That might have actually just gotten a new IP address, and I think I might have just bounced myself out of there. Okay. Cancel out. And even I sometimes lock myself out of machines. It's okay, the machine's sitting right beside me here anyways. /flush DNS. Ping TCHQ VS02. There we go, 10.10.50.6. Take a second to update. So let me just get a new RDP session open here. 10.10.50.6. So just in case you're wondering, it does get a new MAC address. And so because I was DHCPing that, guess what happened? It's going to take and it's going to get a new IP address. And now we are not locked out of this box anymore. Perfect. Okay, so we've got that. Now I need to go grab my NIC configuration file. So TCHQVS01C$. Host install. Now, any of you that have worked with me, you'll always know that it's a server that I've touched because you will see a post install folder. And that post install folder is something that is very, very common for stuff that I work on. And it's just something I've been taught for a very long time because then I can do quick configurations and stuff like this. So I want to make sure that this config is exactly the same as the one that we had yesterday. So I will just highlight down to the points. I didn't create any VLANs actually yesterday. Go ahead and run this. This is going to punt me for a second. Oh, why did that die? Come on now. Why did you die? Oh, as you can see, you need to have elevated command prompt privileges. So you need to open your ISE in administrator context. Go. It's good for you guys to see these little errors as well too, because you're gonna run into this stuff as well and be wondering what the heck's going on. All right, let's try again. Everything except for the VLANs. I just don't have any VLANs connected on my particular switch here. This is actually going to punt me out of the machine here for a second because it's going to take and the virtual switch is going to come across. So once again, I'll typically do this over an ILO connection. So I am probably going to have to take and flush my DNS cache again, because this is going to do the same thing that it did to me on the NIC configuration. So just got to wait for that to finish. It's a lot more exciting when you take and you do this. Flush DNS, ping, TCHQ, VS02, 10.10.240.22 is the IP address now. I have multiple DHCP servers, 10.10.240.22. Yeah, no problem, guys. I know I'm running a little bit late, so the TerraVita server team just has to bounce here. Yeah, for sure, guys. Oh, I'm probably got about 10 minutes left, so if you want, just watch like the back 10 minutes of the video, but thank you very much for jumping in with us, guys. And I just don't want to end this kind of halfway through. All right, so let's see if that did what we wanted it to do. And it looks pretty good, guys. So does that look pretty similar to what we had for the other one? I think so. So now the next step is we just need to go quickly give this an IP address. And this was our number 6, so 172.16.6.2. All of this is fully scriptable, by the way. There's no reason I actually even have to touch the GUI and the UI to do this. You know what? Those had DHCP addresses. I think I just kicked myself off this box. This is kind of comical, actually. So that adapter had a DHCP address on the same subnet. So now it's 10.10.50.7. And I log in again. This is why I do, when you configure this, guys, just remember, configure this over ILO, DRAC, whatever it is, because then you don't get kicked off your system like this. So my new address was 10.10.50.7. So let me guess, that's actually that guy. So let's actually do this the smart way. Status, 10.10.50.9. So I'm just going to get out of here. Log in. Go. All right. Close. Do. Properties. 172.16.5.2. 2255 mask. 2255 mask. Done. All right. So, guys. So, at this point in time, this guy has the Hyper-V role installed. He has the failover clustering installed. He's good to go. That's pretty simple, pretty straightforward, right? So if I open up Hyper-V Manager, I can see him. He's good to go. If I open up Failover Cluster Manager, he is also good to go. So I'm going to go back to the first node here. And so if I take and if I come into Failover Cluster Manager in the first node, all that I have to do is this. I just have to simply just come over to nodes, add a node, next, TCHQVS02. Remember, you want to make sure that your FQDNs are actually going to pop up here for us properly. If this takes a minute, I probably have a little bit of an issue. And what do you guys think the issue is? Those IP addresses have changed themselves how many times in the last few minutes? So remember that DNS problem I was telling you about? ipconfig, flush DNS, ping TCHQVS02. Ping it again. There you go. Now it'll work. Okay, got to make sure you can ping that, guys. Okay, so this is a very, very common problem as you're configuring the networking stack and you're going to stand this stuff up. This is good. This is not good. Okay, this tool here that you're seeing just looks at this. Okay, it's like I've done this a time or two. So eventually that did resolve. I don't trust that. I'm going to do this again. Add node, because I know that that should actually populate fast. TCHQVS02. Add. See how nice and fast that popped in there now? Next. Sure, go ahead and validate. Go ahead. Run the tests. Give her. If you take a look on the bottom down here, you can actually see what this is doing. So it's gathering data about other nodes. It'll actually tell you what node it's actually running the tests on. So it's gathering data about the nodes, looking at the different VMs. So now it's on VS01, and then it'll have to float over and do the same thing on VS02. So see how that actually changed? So if you had like 16 nodes in your cluster, you'd actually see that rolling through each of your cluster nodes. Validating your IPs, making sure everything's okay. Remember, little things like having a NIC disabled is going to be a real pain in your butt, right? Or a network adapter that's not connected, because that'll actually fail this test out. It's actually going through and trying to ping across those different networks right now, making sure that it can communicate. Normally, this will throw a warning because I didn't put a gateway on there. Those aren't routable VLANs, so that's completely normal. So that'll normally just pass a warning. Hyper-V integrated services versions. So it looks like something was a little bit out of date. Once again, just warnings are okay. It's the failures that you want to try to avoid. Okay, it's trying to process the storage configuration to see what SMB test one actually looks like. So it's going to see if it's actually a valid candidate for the cluster. How was the session so far? Did you guys learn a few new things? Because we're going to wrap up here in a couple seconds. I'm just going to get this up and running, and we'll do some quick live migrations to prove that things are working. Feel free to use your chat. This will finish up in just a couple seconds. So instead of having some dead or some idle time, the machine didn't die. Nope. Come on. The more VMs you have in here when you're building these clusters, the longer this takes as well, because it's got to interrogate them and see what's actually going on. Perfect, Scott. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. So Scott was just saying that it was great, and he's going to attend some more of these. I think it's good to actually see this stuff being built up from the ground up too, right? So I know I'm a very, very much so graphical learner when we go through this stuff. So now here's, see this one here, there's a checkbox here, guys. It says add all eligible storage to the cluster. Well, guys, are we even using shared storage right now? No, we're not. So because I'm doing an SMB3 cluster, I actually don't even need that checkbox. So I can turn that off. So I'm just going to go ahead and uncheck that, because you can always add that storage back in afterwards. There's my second node. So I got TCHQ VSO2 now. So now it's in a process of actually joining the cluster. I go ahead and click finish. I can view the report. Remember, the reports are in C Drive cluster reports. Click finish. Go ahead and click on roles. And now I should actually be able to attempt to do a live migration of this thing. So I can move, live migrate, select node. Now I see VSO2 as a viable option. Now remember, guys, remember what I told you about the status option here, right? Kind of happens quick there. So I'm just going to do that again. So you see how that actually moved over to VSO2? So I'm going to move it back to VSO1. And so this is really important for guys like Scott, because you guys are doing what's called shared nothing live migration, where you actually have to physically move the entire file. This live migration capability inside the cluster is much faster, because I only have to move the in-flight memory, because it's all on shared disk, right? So I'm going to go ahead and move that again, show you failover cluster manager. I'll actually connect to my other server, so I got to run that test again. I didn't have both servers in there, so let me just move this again. New, best possible node here, and check that out right here, guys. Where exactly is that state option up here? I just saw a little flash of information. That was it. That frustrates the living heck out of me, not being able to see what's going on. And if you don't understand what's happening, you just sit there, because sometimes those will hang up for a little while. So let me just go connect to TCHQVS02. Here's a second server. And there's that second virtual machine now running on that second server. All right, so guys, just in a quick recap of what we covered for today's session, we walked through the process of standing up a two-node Hyper-V cluster. We did a review of the networking stack that was required for Hyper-V. We took a look at creating a standalone virtual machine, a highly available virtual machine, and we looked at dropping them in and out of the Hyper-V cluster. So I hope everybody really enjoyed the session. I know I don't have any more sessions scheduled right now. I'll probably try to schedule some for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, probably Monday, Tuesday of next week, because Wednesday I'm actually flying out to the Microsoft Ignite show. And then I'm going to probably be on a bit of a hiatus for about 7 to 10 days while I'm on the road there, because it's really hard for me to get dedicated time to do this at the conference, but I may. So just stay on the lookout for an update for this. I will put the recording for this in the same OneDrive folder and location, And guys, thank you very much for taking the opportunity to join me for the session. There'll be a lot more coming. Like I said, we're going to keep going through this until we cover everything operationally that you need to go through to be 100% proficient on this stuff. Okay? Thanks, guys. Have yourself a wonderful day.